I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business. We welcome Liz Nicholson to the show today. She is the wine director at Maialino in the Gramercy Park area of Manhattan. Liz Nicholson of Maialino Restaurant on the show today. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Levy.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
So, you're over there as the sommelier wine director at Maialino in the Gramercy area, an Italian restaurant. And how did that all come about? I mean, were you originally in restaurants?
I was not originally in restaurants. I've been in restaurants for about seven, eight years now. I originally came to New York. I was supposed to be a fashion designer. My first year was spent at FIT here, and then I worked a year in fashion before the label I was working on went under, and I found myself suddenly unemployed, and I decided to go back to my comfort college career of waiting tables just to kind of keep my parents at bay, because I was sure that if I told them I was living on unemployment in New York City, they would have immediately driven out here and hauled me back to Chicago. So I thought, okay, I won't be on unemployment, but I'll just work in a restaurant for a hot second, and I'll, you know, figure out where's my next big fashion move is. And it turned out that my next big move ended up being going deeper and deeper into the depths of the restaurant world.
Oh, cool. Where did you work originally?
My first job was actually at Dos Caminos, so it was with Beer Guest.
What was
and
that like?
Actually, it was. I would say that it's probably the reason that I ended up making the leap over to the dark side. I had been working in fashion, as I was saying, and I was a little bit. I mean, I was young, and I was, you know, obviously, I think you come to New York with these notions of grandeur that, you know, you're in New York City and everything's going to be great, and also coupled with the you just graduated college, it's, you know, I feel like living in New York balanced out with the whole like, oh my gosh, I'm an adult now and I have to pay bills and this isn't, you know, I don't have my parents. And, you know, it was a hard year. It was a hard 2 years between FIT and that. And I was definitely feeling a little bit like every day could be my last in New York. And then I went to the restaurant and I suddenly felt with myself being surrounded by all these unique, interesting, and specifically creative people, which is what I probably am more along the lines of a creative person. And I think that I really connected with the fact that I got to be around so many creative, different people. And then once the food and eventually wine, beverage side, you know, worked its way into my heart, I really just found, I, you know, carved out a little niche for myself in this industry.
So how did you get started with the beverage side?
So I was a server, and I was working at Dos Caminos, as I mentioned. So not necessarily a wine place, but definitely a tequila place. And we had this huge tequila list, over 100 bottles. And, you know, once I had kind of gotten over the initial shock of just understanding, you know, what was different about working in a New York City restaurant, I was very aware of the fact that it bothered me that I was dropping this beverage list on a table and that I didn't know enough about it.
I see.
So I kind of took it upon myself to start teaching myself about tequila, how it's made, you know, and just essentially learning what the difference was in most of the tequilas on our list. And luckily, my chef and my GM took notice. And within Be Our Guest, they, rather than have a specific beverage director at each restaurant, they actually employ a server to essentially teach the staff. And so I was asked to be that person. So then I embarked on this whole world of, you know, training all the new employees.
Oh, okay. So you were training the new employees.
So I was training the new employees. It was, you know, every Wednesday they had to have a class, and it would switch flip flop between a class with a chef about food and a class with me about the tequilas, our cocktails, our wines by the glass, whatnot. So that was the first time. And then in doing that, I also got to start being involved a little bit more with the company. And I would say that I got to go to these, you know, I don't even remember if it was quarterly, monthly, whatnot. It was these meetings at our headquarters, and Laura Manick always ran them. And through doing that, you know, she was the first person that I would say I ever, like, you know, observed and watched that was really in a beverage role. And I was so enamored by her. I was like, she's so cool. She knows so much. She's so passionate. I just, God, you know, and she's, I think, probably the first person who put the bug in my head that I thought, you know, maybe I could maybe do that. You know, I could maybe, if this whole fashion thing doesn't work out, which at the time I was still, you know, jumping from doing little freelance jobs and part-time things and interviewing and waiting for that amazing, perfect job to, you know, show its face, I was still, you know, I was doing that and I was watching her, and she was definitely probably my first inspirational figure that I worked alongside of. And I don't even really, we don't really know each other that well, but just as far as somebody that I was able to watch what they were doing and say, they're doing something cool. And I think I could do that too.
And so what was the next move after that?
So after that, I went, well, I had started kind of going into Inoteca and
on Lower,
on the Lower
East
Side. Yep. This was the when they only had, well, they had Eno and Inoteca, and obviously Jason was at Lupa a lot still then, Jason Den. But I started going to Inoteca, and one thing about me is that I come from actually an Italian background. So I had, you know, my grandmother was, you know, born in Abruzzo, and I had grown up making gnocchi with her, and was always very intrigued and felt much more connected to my Italian side. And as doing so, I, you know, took the language in college. I learned to speak it. I studied abroad there. And I always knew that I, and it was funny because when I took the language in college, it wasn't doing anything for my credits. It was like, you know, just extra credits on top of my normal course load.
Is it language and sign language at the same time with Italian?
It is.
A lot of like,
you know,
how you say, I understand with your finger.
I luckily think that my 50% Italian blood, the sign language was there from birth. I just needed the words.
A lot of arms flapping around the tables
arms
at the dinner.
Yes, a lot of arm, a lot of movements. In fact, that's why I don't like watching our video, because I'm like, oh my God, somebody should have tied my hands behind my back. I'm showing my Italian with my hands.
I had a waiter tell me that he thought I was going to fly away one time. He was like, you're like a helicopter. You use your hands so much, you're going to fly away from the table.
Oh, God bless those Italians. They really know how to. You know what, though? It's an extra level of understanding.
Oh, no doubt.
So I took the language, and here I was in New York, and, you know, obviously for fashion, I thought, maybe I'll get to move to Milan because I can speak Italian. And then instead...
Sure, that makes perfect sense.
Perfect sense. You know, obviously Mucha Prada is going to hire me tomorrow. no experience necessary. What were you last? An assistant designer? Great. I can have you organize these...
collections.
Fabrics,
yeah.
These fabric swatches. So I had, you know, I always kind of like wanted this in on Italy, and I never really knew how it was going to show. And I'd always assumed it would be in the fashion world, that somehow, if I had this Italian background, I could do it. I could get to Milan. I could do something.
But that actually really does make sense to me. I mean, that actually makes sense.
In my mind, you know, as 19, 20-year-old Liz, it made great sense.
Yeah.
And instead, I ended up, you know, 25, walking into my, in Inoteca, cracking open this wine list, and seeing just page after page of just these grapes. And luckily, Francesco Grosso came over to help me because
he was there at that time.
He was the wine director. And so it was an amazing list. And I was, well, I was a little befuddled because here I was like, yeah, I, you know, train all my staff over at Dos Caminos. I know what I'm doing. And I opened this list and was like, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Mars Amino what?
And, but the thing was, more than discourage me, it was like, it like presented itself like a challenge. I thought I had no idea there was this whole element to Italy, and I want to learn it. I want to nail this list. I want to know all these grapes. I want to understand these regions. I want to understand these vintages. I want to know what I'm talking about. And so I immediately started, you know, being like, hey, Francesco, do you think you guys would hire me? Do you think you guys would hire me?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
He's like, I just came over here to sell you a bottle of wine, actually. I'm just kidding.
I let myself become a mild regular. I let him at least recognize me before I started saying, you know, hey, do you think I could come work here? And so
luckily, did he encourage you?
He was, you know, it took a few times of dropping off my resume. And I think the last one was like, come on, really, put in a good word for me. But they did end up hiring me, and I mean, before I was done with my training, I'd already, you know, asked him, said, where do I start? You know, I want to learn this list. And he said, you know, go get Italian Wines for Dummies. And I thought, I'm like, does he think I'm some dumb girl?
Right, right. Is that a personal statement?
Like, is he trying to snub me?
No, but I think he really likes that book, though. He's mentioned it to me.
It's honestly, I think it's the perfect place to start, because it just touches on everything, and it doesn't dive too deep. It doesn't overwhelm. And what I always, and I still suggest it to my staff, and what I say to people is that once, and what I found was that as you start to read about these things and, you know, scratch at the surface, you eventually, if you're really interested and engaged, you start having questions that it can't answer. And that's when you know it's time to move on. And so I probably have read that book through, you know, several times, but I eventually, you know, I just, you know, the Valtelline is a paragraph and I was like, I want to know the specifics on the Sisella and the Grimello and the whatnot. And so you just, you find yourself, you need to just start digging deeper than that. But it's a really great leap off point for just, you know, a basic level of knowledge.
And how did you move further than that? What are some of the things you did to learn even deeper about this?
I don't mind telling people this usually. You know, sometimes when I arrive at the table and people are like, oh, you're the sommelier. I'm like, sure, okay, you can call me that. Because I don't have any formal training. I've really just been somebody who, part of my I would say my textbook might have been Enoteca's list at the time that Francesco was running it.
Because it was a great list. It was a great list.
Him and Joe put together.
There.
Yes. That's how we met.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. You were drinking Enoteca. And it was such a great list to learn off of. And so coupled between the really great wines we poured by the glass, you know, I had flashcards for everything and regularly went through them. And as I was reading through regions, I tried to go out and buy wines from the regions. And I just, I think that you just have to commit everything that you're reading and learning and tasting. You need to commit it to memory, because if you just kind of taste something and go, oh, whatever, then you're not really actually building anything. You're just drinking, frankly. And if you're not really learning about it and building a knowledge base, then you can't do anything. So that's really what I've done. And I've...
It's compare and contrast.
It's a compare and contrast and just constant, you know, you got to keep tasting. You got to remember what you taste and you got to keep reading and learning. And I don't know. You know, people always ask me actually when they're like, you know, you did it. You've just kind of done this yourself. How did you do it? And I just say, you know, you've got to be paying attention and you've really got to be putting the effort in to commit everything to memory. And I would say that traveling also really, I think that it really brings wines to alive for you when you actually get to go to the regions and see them and meet the people who make them and start to understand the culture.
You went to a big trip kind of early on, as I recall.
Yeah. So after I climbed the ranks from server to assistant wine director to wine director at Enoteca.
Oh, okay. That was kind of like around the Bar Milano opening time.
Yes, it was. In fact, that's what ended up giving me the opportunity within that group to grow with them, is because they were opening a new restaurant, which was Bar Milano, which unfortunately they opened literally as that 2008 recession was like the impending doom. And so it only ended up lasting 8 months, and then they turned it into Enoteca, which is what I did with them. I transformed the space from Bar Milano, which was an all northern Italian list, Emilia Romagna North only, and helped shape it into a full blown Enoteca uptown.
Got it. So kind of a big shift.
It was a shift. You know, I got to suddenly pick up a bunch of Southern wine, Central and Southern wine, and had to put away, you know, go through the collection and decide what should get put away to storage as far as for space, you know, since we had such a large collection of just Northern stuff. Obviously, you know, anytime you get yourself in a buying position, you, in New York specifically, you always get to meet producers and you...
Yeah.
You know, people love coming to town. They want to stop into their the restaurants that are selling their wines. And, you know, I just kind of had a lot of open invitations that were kind of like, if you're ever in Piedmont, if you're ever in Tuscany, if you're ever here, if you're ever there. And, you know, it's like at the time it seemed like this fantastic idea of like, God, if I ever could get there. And
yeah.
Then, you know, I eventually started feeling like I can't believe I speak about these wines to this level and I've never seen these soils. I've never been to these vineyards, and I felt like it was something I had to do. I had to go, I had to see these places. So in 2009, I went over for 3 months. And
that's a significant amount of time.
It's a significant amount of time. And day one was Valdosta. So I literally started in the northwest corner and snaked my way across the north, working three harvests. So I spent my first 2 months all in the north. And then the last month was this, like, I was very much more on the move. I didn't end up staying in most regions more than, you know, 2-3 days, maybe seeing anywhere from 1 to 3 or 4 wineries while I was there in each region. But I did end up covering the whole country except for Sardinia and in the time span of 3 months, and saw over 60 wineries, worked harvest of 3. And it was really like a...
foundational kind of thing.
It was a foundational, and yet sometimes I'm so bummed that I did it by myself, because there's so many moments from traveling that country. You know, I put four, wait, no, I put 7,000 kilometers on that car. Wait, no, four. I spent $3,000 in gas, put all this mileage on this car. Luckily, it was unlimited mileage, thank God. And I drove really that whole country. And there's so many incredible sights and just funny moments that I had that I just can't believe that I'm the only one who knows them. I wish I'd had a camera on my head the whole time.
You did, so you did write a blog at the first part of it.
I did. And at the beginning, when I was more... when I was a little bit more rooted in staying places, it seemed easier, except for the fact that...
Because of Wi-Fi and stuff.
Well, in Piedmont, I couldn't get any internet access. I had to drive to Alba. So there was this wine bar in Alba that I'd kind of started going to, and I had a card. I didn't need a place with Wi-Fi. I had an internet card. I just needed to get somewhere that it could get a signal. And these people were probably thought I was crazy. Like this American girl who sat there for like 3 hours uploading pictures and... writing, and they were like, who? And like, meanwhile, they had any nomadic machines. So I'm like, trying. I'm like, oh, well, great. I'd love to try the Brico de Chalone. Fantastic. I'm so glad you have it by the glass. And they were like, who is this girl? And I'd like be like plugging in my phone to charge. They probably thought I was nuts, but whatever. I eventually, though, once I had to be more on the move, I realized I couldn't really fully blog while I was going, because I had to figure out where was I going the next day, where was I staying, how was I getting there, what time were my appointments.
And you were driving all the time.
And I was driving, yeah.
Like you didn't have someone else to switch off with you. Mm-hmm. That's a big commitment.
Yeah.
I think, you know, because it makes a big difference when you can just zone out.
And then, you know, there's the whole extra fun of finding places in Italy, which if you've ever tried to find places... find wineries in Italy versus finding wineries in, you know, Napa, California, where there's signs and everything's clearly marked. And actually, even at the very end of the trip, I was in Montalcino, and that seemed like crazy to me, the fact that it was so well marked. You know, I remember finding Radicon. The only way I found Radicon was because I knew they lived, were neighbors with Grosvenor, and there was no posted address sign, and the numbers were going all over the place. But it was the only unposted address. It was a driveway. And it was across the street from what I assume was Grosvenor's house, because there was a bunch of M4 in the yard. And I was like, well, I'm willing to bet this is Grosvenor's house, so I'm just going to take a leap of faith and go down this driveway. And I drove down, and there was this garbage can that was overflowing with Radicon bottles. I said, found it.
That's hilarious.
I know. Well,
I've had that same problem where there's no mark. Like, I've even had people not be able to give me an address.
Yeah.
I went to La Stopa and they're like, well, we'll give you the Google Earth coordinates, but we don't have
I had people give me address. Google Earth coordinates too. And, you know, there was only one winery I never found. And it was ironic. It's a big winery. Is the Terre delle Sevi, the Ray Manfredi in Basilicata, which you're driving. Basilicata is like barren.
Right.
There's nothing to see.
It's like Montana.
And it's like driving around it's like driving around Death Valley.
Yeah.
And the fact that you wouldn't be able to be like, oh, look, there's a giant structure in the distance.
Right,
that must be it.
A lot of workers.
Yeah. I spent 40 minutes driving around. And at that point, I was going to Cantina del Notaio next. And I said, screw it. I'm going to just get to my next appointment because this is not working. So,
and you eventually made it back. You found your way back to New York.
Found my way back to New York, and I found my way back to New York because to be honest, I had envisioned when I left for this trip that it might be the end of my New York stint.
You imagine kind of staying in Italy.
Well, I was open to that idea, but I also thought that maybe I'd go back to Chicago, which is where I'm from. And I was over there, and I'm actually like looking at Craigslist, and some of my good friends in Chicago are saying, this place is great and this place is great. And I'm sending blind emails to people saying, hey, you know, I work in Italian wine. I've been the beverage director here and I'm currently traveling through Italy and I'm, you know, looking to come back to Chicago in December. And, you know, I don't know if there's any opportunity. No one, not a single person from Chicago ever wrote me back. No one, not even
really?
For, sometimes they were for like high-end server positions. No one wrote me back, and yet people from New York were writing me saying, what are you doing? What's your plan when you get back? And so for me, I just kind of felt like, you know, I feel like I've got way more of a connection and a rooting in New York. And so I came back, and originally I came back to help out at Resto.
Oh, okay,
which is
that's right.
A focus on Belgian beer, which after being in Italy for 3 months, I was like, what am I doing?
But that dude used to work at Inoteca.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that was that.
Part of the Inoteca family. And we were at the time in talks about a future project that never ended up coming to fruition. And it was becoming clear to me while I was there that it wasn't maybe nearly as close as we had as we had been in talks about while I was in Italy. So I was starting to think about, you know, what am I going to do if this doesn't work out? And then that's when I got tapped to come interview for the Maialino wine director position.
And what was that interview like, or series of interviews?
It was with Terry Coughlin, who's now our director of operations and was at the time the general manager. And
Of Maialino.
And he's been with the company for years. He started as a, you know, I don't know if he started as a captain or maybe worked his way up to captain at Gramercy Tavern and then went to Tabla and opened it and was the GM and opened Maialino. So he's been with our company for a long time. I think has a good pulse on what our company is specifically looking for, which is essentially just energetic, passionate, excitable, warm people.
It seemed like that's what he filled the room with at Maialino.
Yeah.
When it first opened, I remember there was a lot of younger people who seemed really excited to be there.
Yeah, I mean, Danny in his book, he talks about, you know, our company always seeks the 51%ers with the idea that if 51, you know, 1% over half of their being is that, you know, hospitable warmth that want to, you know, take care of people, the other 49% is just technical skills. This is how you clear, this is how you pour wine, this is how you mise a table. So if you can teach them the 49, great, but you can't teach them the 51. So I think that essentially,
because when I talked to him, I was like, can you teach me how to break down the percentage? Like, I don't
you were like, 51. You're like, that's an F.
is this an unbalanced equation?
Yeah. I know. It took me a while. At first when I got hired, I'm like, I don't understand this 51 thing. But you know, it's a great philosophy.
Because I came from San Francisco. So I was like, 49ers? Awesome.
You're like, I am a 49er. We're like, great. We're looking for 51ers.
Yeah. Wasn't so popular.
Yeah.
Totally kidding. Please go ahead.
No, it's all right. So I think that when I came, I just, you know, I was still somewhat fresh off. I'd only been back in the States 4 months. I was still, you know, so excitable about this crazy trip I just done. And
yeah,
I think that to him,
you still are today.
I still am today. I just told you a funny story about how I found Radicon.
Hi, nice to meet you. My name's Liz. Did I tell you about Radicon? Like, yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it comes off.
I tend to be that way.
Yeah.
So
in a good way, though, in the best way.
I would like to think it's a good way. So anyways, yeah, I just, you know, I met him and then I had to come back and meet our chef, Nick Anderer, and meet, you know, he made me meet all the management team. And then I actually had met Danny. And my first day I met Danny. And it's funny because it's actually probably the most bizarre conversation I've ever had with him because I think.
Oh, really?
Well, Danny loves Italy. I think Maialino is the restaurant he's always wanted to open. And so I think that the idea of letting this outsider come in.
Oh, okay.
And he had, you know, he knew Stephen Mancini, the previous wine director. And I think that he probably had a lot of suggestions on the opening wine list. And so I think he was a little nervous at first, like, who is this girl? And you know, he kind of was, you know, giving me breakdowns of what he really likes to see on the list. But the amazing thing is that's the only time he ever once has made, I was like, oh God, I've got to make sure that I don't, you know, put any weird wines on that he doesn't like. And the irony of this is that 3 months later, he was kind of like, you know, you've got this. I love what you're doing. And they've never, you know, really, they've allowed me creative license to kind of do what I want there.
Which is super important.
Which is really important. I think that it's, you know, when you work a beverage program, it's a lot of hours. It's, you know, late nights. You are always constantly being thrown, you know, like little ringers like, oh, that wine came in. Oh, or the wine didn't come in. Or, oh, it switched vintages and this and that. Or, you know, the PDR blew through 2 cases of this wine and now we're 86th and we pour it by the glass. You know, you're always constantly juggling these things. And I think at the end of the day, if you're still allowed to essentially make your mark and make your own personal creative statement, then that's the best thing. And for me, as somebody who came to New York to be a creative person, I think that it's really important for my own personal brain and excitement and, you know, feeling like I'm still fulfilling that level of my, you know, personality.
To get past the mundane. Yeah. details.
Yeah,
of the day.
and my GM is always like, Liz, I get it, you're a creative person. I know, because I'm, you know, they're like structure, 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 and I'm like, woo.
But how did that play out? Because I remember when the restaurant first opened, there was a lot of kind of varietally focused wines, I felt like. There was kind of like Brunello, there was Barolo, and then there
was
like
a Pinot
Pinot Nero.
And there was a Chardonnay.
Right.
And there was a Chianti. I know, it was a
and
very...
And they were varietally labeled, which is unique for... Not often is that the case with Italy. Well, a lot of times it's hidden under the DOC.
Yes. So. And it was a very straightforward wine list. And that was another reason.
It was like Scuba and stuff like that. And it was not that big.
It was 89 bottles on
89 selections.
89 selections on the list when I started. And I don't know how I've crammed almost 350 now there. And
wow, that's quite a bit bigger.
It's, well, and especially considering I'm still working in the same space. I'm on the verge of dropping, you know, dropping boxes from the ceiling in the cellar to just start having floating bins.
Yeah, it's like those... those like air guns that come from the ceiling in the mechanic's place. So like, you just grab it, pull it down.
Grab it and pull it down. And there's a whole other cellar in the ceiling. So yeah, that's what I need. Definitely work on inventing one of those, because I would buy it. It was definitely a safe list. And so I also wondered if that had a lot to do with the clientele.
Uh-huh.
And I wondered if I was like, you know, maybe I can't.
Yeah.
Maybe I can't really push the envelope here.
You don't want to. Because Enotech was a little bit more like, this is super regional. Like, it was a little bit more like very obscure.
And that's how I was raised. I mean, that's the way I was. That's how my eyes were opened to Italy. So, and I think it's really, I think that idea.
Where's the Lacrima Christi d'Alba?
I know.
Yeah.
We need those tears of Christ.
The first thing
I did that was a little bit wonky, this was my test run, was I took off that Pinot Nero by the glass and replaced it with a stainless steel Gallioppo, which obviously, you know, everyone knows Gallioppo. And that was my first test run and it went well. And so then it was like slowly but surely, I just have now, I mean, I actually am in this weird moment where I'm back to this mildly approachable list, because I have a Sauvignon Blanc and a Pinot Grigio by the glass right now, which I almost am like...
Wow, and you admit it in public and
stuff. I admit it, but the Pinot Grigio is a Romato.
Oh, right. So
and,
it's get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yeah, it's my get-out-of-jail-free card. And so I know, I'm like, oh, I can't believe I have this. But at the same time...
Do you find brushback on the Romato thing? It's like the person that's ordering the Pinot Grigio not expecting that?
No, because when we poured it by the glass previously, it's the Decimus from Vita Romans, and there's always the problem because Italy doesn't tend to oak a lot of their whites either, and if they do, it's usually their top wine, and so it's not really in a by-the-glass price point. So, and I'm not saying actually it's a $17 glass. It's not a cheap glass of Pinot Grigio. So you kind of figure that there's a... there's that price point that makes it a little bit more, but the staff is all trained in knowing that
they know what's up.
When somebody just says, oh, a glass of Pinot Grigio, you'd be like, okay, I just want to let you know, this is actually, it's going to be just a slight brush tint. It's called a Romato and there is some oak on it. And then that way it kind of gives that person who was like, oh, no, I just want something like light and crisp. And we obviously have plenty of things. And, you know, we have to talk a lot at Maialino about verbiage and how to talk people into weird wines, but that's how I was essentially raised. So for me, it's like, this is what I've always done. I've spent my whole wine career coaching people from international varietals into something Italian. And
is that kind of the burden of the, you know, or the joy of the Italian sommelier?
I think that you have to look at it as a joy, because at the end of the day, you know what? Like, the reason these little grapes exist, the Gallioppos of the world and the, you know, Ossolettas and all these little itty-bitty guys, and the reason they exist is because someone in that region clung to tradition. And they clung to the fact that this was a regional grape and their father grew it or their grandfather grew it and whatnot, and they're going to keep the tradition. And I, in many ways, feel that at this point I've kind of grown into this, like, ambassador level or a certain... To a certain degree, I've taken the time to learn them, and it's my job to make sure that the world knows about them too. And so that's why I would say it's got to be a joy, because you've got to be excited and happy to tell people about these grapes, because it's kind of like keeping them from becoming endangered. Because if we all just started drinking Chardonnay and Cabernet and Merlot, what would happen well, what happened to all those little grapes? And they've been hanging on for hundreds of years there. And there's people that have for generations been cultivating them. And, you know, I feel like I'm here for them at this point. It's my job to make sure that I spread the love and make sure people still know about them and that they continue on for more generations and keep that culture alive.
And have you found that getting the staff on your side in that process is helpful?
Yeah, I think that at this point, I think that if you want to come work at Maialino, you've got to be somebody who is excited to learn, because you need to embrace it as well. Again, like if you're going to look at it as a burden, then go work someplace with an American list. If you want to learn, and I'll go on a mild tangent. People always say to me, because I sometimes get really self-conscious about the fact that I'm such an Italian bred person and that I can't recite all the Grand Crus of Burgundy, and even though I love drinking it, and I can't, like, you know, be as knowledgeable in other areas as much as I try. And people always say to me, God, how did you ever learn Italy? I look at it and it's too much for me. You know, almost 1,000 native varietals. I don't even understand how you ever even broke through. And to me, it's, you know, it's one of those things that's like, well, you have to want to. You have to care. You have to want to know that Pellaverga is a grape that's only grown in the town of Verduno, which is at the top of the Barolo zone. And, you know, you have to find them interesting and fascinating. And if you are interested and fascinated, then you've got tons to learn at Maialino, whether you work there or whether you just come in to drink, because we pour almost 40 wines by the glass. Actually, it really is 40. In fact, sometimes it's been more like 42. And we always are featuring a different region or grape or something. And so I would say that I've kind of built my By the Glass program as a training ground for Italian wine.
And how has that worked with the customers? Because, you know, Danny's really known for hospitality and making people feel comfortable. Has there been any pushback, or has it just been cool?
I would be lying if I said there wasn't pushback. I mean, and I shouldn't say pushback, but I just on last Sunday had to listen to a server just, you know, she was so upset because this guy was so mean to her because...
I said I was sorry.
Of course it was you. No, he told her he liked Chianti, and she tried to open his eyes to this other blend, and then he hated it. And when she tried to make a suggestion, he told her, well, you didn't do so great the first time. And so she just, it was, you know, I was heartbreaking and listening to her. She was so upset, and, you know, because she's one of my people who's really...
She wants to do it. She was trying to make the connection.
She was trying to make the connection and do her job, and instead she just kind of got pushed down. And I know that she... And it was sad to see her, and I said, you know what? Hey, I'm like, you got to let these things roll off your back. You know, don't let this... You can't let yourself feel like you can't... Like, if somebody says Chianti, just offer Chianti. It's like, you know, you have to continue to do this. And I would say that 9 out of 10 people are great, because we've seen a huge uptick in our drinking scene in the bar. And I think
it's always busy when I go.
But it's people who literally just come in just to treat it like a wine bar. And that's really great for us.
Well, there are a lot of options. And you have that Enomatic machine.
Mm-hmm. We have the Enomatic machine, which keeps 12 lines at temperature, which is my favorite part of it, and stored. I mean, to be honest, we move wine so quickly that I've never once had to actually test the, like, does this really last the whole month they say it does? Because
right.
The wines turn
place.
Over. And for me, I'm always just excited when I can get things, when I have a slot for something in the machine, because it means one more wine that gets to be poured at temperature.
But I mean, I feel like you've done some thematic work with the machine. Like you've done things that were, hey, we're going to have 12 of this or 12 of that, whether it's region or grape.
We do. Currently, we're in our second round of doing Nebbiolo. The other part of this backstory is that the company had purchased this 12-slot Enomatic machine when they were opening Maialino, and I wasn't with them then. And just, I think, in the craziness of opening, and it was just like, it kind of became this like burden, and it just kind of got...
Is that because of speed?
Speed, well, you know, you're opening, you're crazy, they're ripping through, they're opening a new bottle of things by the glass every 5 minutes. They can't keep loading bottles in and out of the machine.
You're
and
like, oh,
you know,
the cord goes in here and a spout through there.
Yeah. So they abandoned it. And so it just turned into this, you know, beautiful display case, essentially
right.
showing what we were pouring by the glass, but they
weren't
using
the Vanna White
it.
Of wine by the glass.
It was a beautiful Vanna, and we didn't even have to buy our new dress. So it was just a showcase. It was a display case when I started, and they said, "Hey, we would really like to get this back into use. And what do you think you can do?" And knowing that they'd already faced the challenge trying to pour every wine, every red by the glass out of it was didn't really work for them. I essentially created, we've got our normal by the glass, and then we have a secondary program, which is always a theme. And the opening theme was Nebbiolo Bar. And the original theme for that one had been, I'm like, okay, so we've got Gamay, we've got Tanara, we have Barolo, we have Barbaresco, we've got Longarero, and then you've got Valtellina, and you've got, so I figured out there was 12 expressions. You also have Chiavanasca. They do it as a white expression up north, and sparkling and rosé. And I was like, okay, I'm going to showcase one selection of each of these different styles. And that was how we leapt off. And luckily it was a huge, huge success. And so then after that, I was like, okay, well, what happens next? And then it was the great reds of Northeast Italy. And then we did Sicily Erupts. And then we did The Hills Are Alive with Sangiovese, which is one of my favorite titles. One of my servers came up with it. I can't take credit. But so we've essentially now keep using that machine to put a focus on either an area. We did the summer on the Adriatic this past summer, so it really covered spanned several regions. It did, Marche, Abruzzo, Puglia, even dipping up a little bit into Emilia Romagna. And trust me, I had plenty of reps being like, "But what about Friuli? What about the Colio? It's on the Adriatic." And I was like, I can't even get into that can of worms, or else it would just there would be 40 wines on the Enomatic program alone. But it's been a great tool, not only for the staff to kind of open their eyes, like, okay, here's the grapes you see from here. Or like right now we're doing Nebbiolo again, and we're doing War of the Nebbioli. And it's a north versus south expression, because you've got the famous vineyards of Barolo and Barbaresco, and then the second most understandable wines, which, oh, Langhe Nebbiolo, I know that. Oh, Nebbiolo d'Alba, great. You have these expressions that from the southern part of Piedmont, which are usually the more expensive and the more classic, if you will. But then you have those great regions in the north. You've got Gemme and Gattinara, and now we're increasingly seeing more wines from like Lissona and just Costa della Sessia, DOC, which is the river that separates Gemme and Gattinara, and just wines that are kind of grown right around there. And then my all-time favorite, which is the Valtellina, and which is another, the furthest north expression you see of Nebbiolo. And then also dabbling in a little bit into Valdosta. So we've got essentially a selection, I think 9 selections from the north versus 9 selections from the south.
That's interesting. Do
Yeah.
you find that customers are kind of coming back to the themes? Kind of like, hey, what's going on with this? It kind of gives them conceptually a framework.
Yeah, actually, I think that the coolest thing about it is that, and not that you should discourage bottle sales, but people are opting to play by the glass versus just getting that one bottle.
So they can
And
try a few
so
different
they can
things.
try a few different things. And it's really fun. And it's for me, it's personally rewarding to let people know that there is all these northern selections, because I think that they're really beautiful wines in their own, and they deserve a little more attention, and they're really great values. And I always love to kind of let people, so sometimes, especially if they're starting with a salad, is there any possibility, like, great, you should try this nice lean Valtellina, and then when you get your steak, or your Maialino al forno in the next course, that's when you can have that glass of Barolo.
And have you had a chance to get back to Italy itself on another trip?
I did. I went twice this year. It was a good year.
When were you there?
I was there in March, and I went to my first in Italy.
Oh, how was that?
It was good. It was actually, I always, I for as long as I've known about it, I'm like, for years, but for like, the 5, 6 years that I've even known when Italy happened,
Because that's the big wine fair.
it's the huge wine fair in Verona. I imagine it to be like 4 days of going to Trebicchieri, which is like a headache. By the end of the day, you're just exhausted. It's, you've been beating the crowds down. You've been trying to like run and get those tastes of those wines, but it was actually not anything like Trebicchieri. It
What
was,
was it like?
it's it's just outside the city, and they basically build it out. They each region has its own huge kind of like expo center-y
Oh,
thing.
really? So there's like a whole like
Yeah.
separate building.
Each region has its own building, and then so you can just kind of go in and you're walk around and see different regions. Now, technically, you really should work by appointment. You should be planned enough and focused ahead of time to...
Oh, is that true? You're supposed to make appointments evidently? I actually didn't know that.
You are supposed to make appointments, but at the same time, like, you know, you can still, especially if you know people and you show up and they're like, oh my God, you're here from New York, they're not going to not make time for you.
But that's kind of neat that it's arranged regionally.
Yeah. And so you can really kind of just walk through and, you know, it's like, it's funny. We hadn't had a Lugana on the list, and you know, Lugana is one of those categories. It's a white wine, you know, from Lake Garda. And sometimes it dips onto the Veneto side and sometimes it dips into the Lombardia side. It's kind of, it's a region that actually, or is a wine zone that crosses the border. And some Luganas are simple and, you know, not exciting. And then I've had in my life a few that were cool. And so I remember just walking through like the Lugana producers and just being like, what's cool? What's happening? It was nice to be able to like get your eyes on like what's happening in this region because everyone's there.
Is that difficult just in the New York sense? Because I feel like, okay, this guy's got one Lugana, that guy's got one Lugana, this importer brings in two Brunellos and two Barolos, but that's what they bring in. Is it difficult to do the thing that you can do in France where you're like, hey, I really want to line up some Burgundies and try them as samples comparatively because it's so kind of with Italian wine, a little bit balkanized. Yep. Like this guy's got two, that guy's
it's
got
fragmented.
Two.
There are, some of the consorcios have big tastings. Like I know there's... what is it called? Benvenuto Brunello.
Sure.
Or, right. You know, I know that in like Chianti, obviously, especially the bigger consortios that have the money to do it, to have the, you know, budget to like host these giant tastings and groupings. But I kind of stopped going to some of them because I hate to tell you, I mean, I hate to say this. I find that it's a lot of the little guys there that are really looking to get into the scene rather than right. like the really legit guys.
And
that
there's
are,
a reason that they're not on the scene.
They're like, I don't even need to be part of this big trade show because I already sell. My wine's all allocated and I don't need to be popping bottles for the public to taste. You know,
you
when,
don't see Valentini hanging out at
Yeah, you do not see Valentini. There's definitely no Soldera at the Brunello.
Right.
And there won't be for, I know, it's so sad. It's such a sad thing. And I, so I would say that the best thing you can do is really know people's portfolios and putting some thought in before you just start tasting. You know, I don't have time to do every single tasting appointment.
Is there really enough time to have a great multi-regional Italian list anymore just because there are so many importers and they all have a little bit? I mean, is it difficult?
It is, but I mean, at this point now, I'm mildly set in my ways. And
you have your people.
I have my people and... At the same time, there's still movement, and I think it's important. Excuse me. I think it's important to keep tasting and allow those doors to open for the new guys. But a lot of times, I rely on my reps. I'll be honest. If they got something that's really cool in their portfolio, if my rep comes to me and is like, "We just picked up this dude. Has never ever exported to the U.S. You know, Neil or Doug or whoever. You know, found them on their last trip. Whoever who they work with said, hey, let me show you my friend's wines. And somehow, like, one wine that comes to mind right now is Pettorino. We're pouring the 96 Scotchnara now. 96 Scotchnara. This guy hasn't been exporting wine. The current vintage is 2001. That's crazy for Scotchnara. And the 96, they went to visit the estate, and he had it in tanks. And they were like, what are you doing sitting on this 96? And the guy was like, I don't have anywhere to put it. What am I going to do with it? And they were like, well, I'll tell you what, put this in bottles and you send it to the States and we'll take care of this for you. And Morgan Rich told me, I mean, 7 months before the wine showed up, he said, because they came and said, we just got this great new Gratinara producer and I picked it up and was like, awesome. And they said, and after that trip, they said, so guess what? Down the road, we're going to get some 96. And I was like, I'm doing Nebbiolo again in the fall. I want to pour that 96.
Yeah.
And I like literally just took my, I was like, I want you to put this much aside for me. And I had when it was actually coming, I had a moment that I thought to myself, I'm like, I haven't even tasted this, but this is a terrible idea. But the juice is so fresh because it just got bottled. Like you would never even, tasting a blind, you would never guess it was a 96. It's so beautiful.
But aside from that, I feel like you guys often have some back vintage stuff, especially like Chatterton, kind of older Barlow, older Quintarelli. Is that kind of a strength as well? Or?
It certainly is a strength. I am nearing the end of some of my Poggio Sotto, which really brings the tear to my eye.
Can you save some for me?
I actually already had a guest come be like, where can I get this? I'm like, if you find out, tell me because I need more of it.
Right.
Well, Kermit Lynch is now going to be importing the wines.
But it's changed ownership, right?
Yeah. It has changed ownership. granted, that is new now, and so the wine, the first wines that come in should still be essentially made by Piero Pabucci. So,
But you're like pouring it by the glass and stuff, right?
yeah,
Yeah.
very for a very short time longer. If
I know where I'm going tonight for a
you
glass of
actually,
wine.
this might be the last weekend of the 01 Progetto di
Really?
Brunello.
Because that's a great year, too.
It's a great year and it's a
Yeah.
beautiful wine, and that's why I need to be selfish and save the rest of it for the bottle by the bottlist. But yeah, no, I am very lucky in that I don't even bet. We're also pouring 96 Vini del Ruol from Rocca di Manzoni by the glass, and 03 Mascarello. So we,
Barlow.
yeah, Barlo.
So chattered and stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact that I can just be like, cool, I'm going to pour that by the glass. I mean, I'm lucky for the relationships that were forged before my time that have
Because
a
Danny was always close with Chattered.
Danny and, yeah. And also Richard Crane, who's one of the other head partners at our country. He's our company.
It is almost like a
It
country
is
now.
almost like, yeah,
A lot of
isn't
burgers, gross production.
But Richard Crane is also very was very tight with him. So I'm literally riding on the coattails of some of the founders of my company and their connections, and that's great.
Well, I think you're doing a good job too. Liz from Maialino, thank you for being here today.
Thanks, Lovey.
All Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe, alldrinktothatpod.com, or on Twitter at drinktothatpod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.